timetable has been announced yet. Homolesky, Vienna.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the US is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
The European Commission says in recent years, EU member states have been intimidated by foreign countries in the area of trade. A new policy proposal has been unveiled to counter the use of economic coercion perpetrated by non-EU nations.
The EU considered the Iran nuclear deal to be one of its greatest foreign policy achievements. Do you think if we had more mechanisms like this in place before now, the nuclear deal would have been saved by now?
It's not the instrument which is there to resolve all problems, and we are clearly targeting it for economic coercion, but it certainly strengthens our toolbox to react to different possible situations.
Illegal sanctions introduced by Donald Trump when he was in office threatened there will be harsh consequences for any EU government or firm that does business with Iran. The former US president did all in his power to destroy the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The EU is currently mediating discussions in Vienna between Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany to try and save the accord.
This is the seventh round of talks this year. We hope that we will be able to move forward because there is no alternative. Diplomacy needs to deliver, and the only way how we can deliver is to have this agreement back on track.
The International Atomic Energy Agency repeatedly confirmed that Iran was fully complying with the terms of the JCPOA when Trump pulled the US out of the UN-backed agreement in 2018. Senior EU officials have told me privately they are bewildered by the announcement on Tuesday from Washington that the US is to impose new sanctions on Iran as the talks in Austria proceed. A growing number of political commentators say Joe Biden is completely incompetent when it comes to foreign policy. They cite Afghanistan and the JCPOA as just two examples. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Mimi Sanko, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, had declared herself mystified that Biden's Department of Justice would not negotiate with her members despite the U.S. president vocally touting his purported support for workers' representation. We now present you an article written jointly by Alexander Villarreal and Joanna Walters. The piece is titled Victory for U.S. Immigration Judges at Biden Administration Recognizes Union. Stunning victory, U.S. immigration judges have settled a tense dispute with President Joe Biden's administration over their effort to restore union rights taken away from them under former President Donald Trump. Biden's Department of Justice agreed on Tuesday, 7th of December, to recognize the union as the exclusive representative for the nation's immigration judges and follow the terms of their collective bargaining agreement, at least for the time being. Days before reaching the settlement, the head of the Federal Immigration Judges Union had accused the Biden administration of doubling down on its predecessor's efforts to freeze out their association, even as they struggle with a backlog of almost 1.5 million court cases and staff shortages, which exacerbate due process concerns in their courts. Mimi Sankoff, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, had declared herself mystified that Biden Department of Justice would not negotiate with her members despite the U.S. president vocally and frequently touting his purported support for workers' representation. Mimi Sankoff said before the settlement, this administration has really doubled down on maintaining the Trump position that we are not a valid union. Sankoff was appointed as an immigration judge back in 2006 and is based in New York, where she also teaches at Fordham University School of Law. She spoke to The Guardian only in her union role. After what she described as decades of relatively smooth relations between the National Association of Immigration Judges and the Department of Justice, former U.S. President Donald Trump capped 4 years of right-wing immigration policy by successfully petitioning to strip hundreds of immigration judges of their right to unionize. The hostile move was decided by the Federal Labor Relations Authority, an independent administration federal agency that controls labor relations between the federal government and its employees, on 2nd of November 2020, the day before the presidential election. Despite a Democratic victory and Joe Biden taking the White House, pledging to undo damage done by Donald Trump, the union remained shut out and silenced for more than a year, without a date set to hear its case attempting to restore its official status. Mimi Sankoff said, "I cannot understand it, working together, as the president has claimed, working with federal employees, working with unions, achieves better results." The Justice Department did clear the way in June for the judges' union to at least ask for its rights back when the Executive Office for Immigration Review, home of the country's immigration courts, withdrew opposition to the National Association of Immigration Judges' motion for reconsideration. However, Mimi Sankoff said the administration has still been refusing to negotiate, which led the National Association of Immigration Judges to accuse the Executive Office of Immigration Review of unfair labor practices. The complaint in question accused the Executive Office of Immigration Review of interfering with, restraining and coercing employees in the exercise of their rights to organize and refusing to negotiate in good faith. She said in a telephone interview recently, "Good faith in my mind would have said if we really cared about this union, this administration would have started negotiating with us, but they haven't, so we're really mystified as to why." She added, "I don't think there's any other way to say it. They have simply doubled down on this policy, and it is counterintuitive given the positions that the president has set forth." In a formal response to the complaint, the Executive Office for Immigration Review stated that, in essence, the National Association of Immigration Judges is defunct. Administration officials went so far as to file a motion to dismiss the National Association of Immigration Judges' grievances about unfair labor practices, though the motion was denied. But on Tuesday, 7th of December, the U.S. administration changed its tune, agreeing to recognize the union and make other concessions in exchange for the National Association of Immigration Judges withdrawing its charges of unfair labor practices. The administration will continue to recognize the union unless the FLRA denies the motion for reconsideration. The Executive Office for Immigration Review does not comment on continuing litigation. Even with the conflict reaching a detente, the nation's immigration courts are still tackling crushing caseloads with severe shortages of vital personnel such as legal assistants and translators. Mimi Sankoff said one of the New York immigration courts only had about 30% of the staff it needs, and other courts in cities as geographically diverse as Memphis, Salt Lake City, and Philadelphia have been short of staff for years. The lack of personnel makes it more difficult for judges to be fully prepared for hearings and can even affect whether those in front of the courts, often including migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, receive adequate notice of important changes to their cases. She suggested the shifting political priorities between administrations might have focused resources on law enforcement instead of hiring more staff to make the immigration courts run more efficiently. Mimi Sankoff said, "It is a very real impact on the ability of respondents who are seeking justice to ensure that they're receiving a fair hearing." Meanwhile, migration advocates have warned the Biden administration's move to revive the former U.S. President Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy will subject thousands of people to enormous suffering and leave them vulnerable to kidnap and abuse as they languish in dangerous Mexican border cities. After reaching a deal with Mexico, the United States will start returning asylum seekers from other Latin American countries to Mexico, where they will be obliged to wait while their case is being assessed. Under the policy first implemented by Donald Trump, asylum seekers were left stranded in violent Mexican border cities, where they were routinely targeted by organized crime groups for rape, robbery, extortion, and abduction. The U.S. government is promising to improve the scheme to allow asylum seekers legal representation and to conclude their claims within 6 months of an individual's initial return to Mexico. Mexico claimed U.S. officials met its concerns over funding for migrant shelters, protection for vulnerable groups, and access to medical checkups and COVID-19 vaccines. It also promised to take local safety conditions into account before accepting asylum seekers, a pledge that provoked disquiet among migrant advocates. But advocates argue that the main shortcomings of the program are unchanged.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. China, referring to the recent U.S.-sponsored summit on democracy, has said that Washington is using democracy as a weapon of mass destruction. Beijing says the U.S. is guilty of inciting division and instigating color revolutions. Now the U.S. is accused of trying to divide the world even further. This as entities such as Israel was invited to participate when it practices apartheid on a daily basis, and Taiwan, which is considered a part of China, was invited, and Beijing was not, by the country that actually stands accused of being anything but democratic, the United States of America.
The controversial two-day U.S. Summit for Democracy has been concluded. The event was held virtually with over 100 countries in attendance.
So let's raise up our ambitions and rise up to meet the challenges together. Thank you, and I look forward to following through in the next year on all the commitments we're making individually. Thank you.
The U.S. faced scrutiny over how it went about deciding which countries to invite. China and Russia were the highest profile names left off the invite list. China was especially upset because it was not invited, whereas China was. The island is a major source of contention between China and the U.S. over Washington's military and political support for Taiwan that seeks independence from mainland China.
In efforts to maintain its hegemonistic status, the U.S. has abused the public idea of democracy to serve its selfish interests, instigated division and confrontation under the pretext of democracy, sabotaged the U.N.-centered international system, and the international order based on international law, which are all outright acts against democracy.
Beijing slammed Washington over seeking to use democracy as a pretext for imposing hegemony. China says the U.S. is using democracy as a weapon of mass destruction to interfere in other countries. Russia also accuses the Biden administration of exhibiting a Cold War mentality that will stoke up ideological confrontation in the world. Questions have been raised on why the U.S. should hold such a summit, a country accused of rights violations at home and abroad. At home, Washington is suffering from problems like racial injustice that has stirred massive nationwide protests over the killing of innocent African Americans. The U.S. has also been criticized for its controversial election system, which is not based on popular vote. A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. Abroad, the U.S. is the major supporter of Israel, which has occupied Palestinian lands and unleashed atrocities and wars on Palestinian people. It is also the main supplier of arms to countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The two countries are involved in the Yemen conflict that has left tens of thousands of innocent people dead. The U.S. itself has also invaded countries like Iraq and Afghanistan under the pretext of bringing democracy and fighting terrorism. But death and destruction have been the only outcome. Many believe that the U.S. describes only its allies as democratic countries just because they comply with its foreign policy dictates and policies. It also resorts to undemocratic means and weaponizes democracy as a tool to pressure countries to align themselves with Washington's interests.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, veteran journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels. And writer and political commentator Fabrizio Godoni out of Como, Italy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Brussels. And Elijah, what do you think the overall goal of the summit was?
I think the summit, thank you for having me, first of all.
Thanks for coming.
I think the summit is directed toward the countries who are not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. And I think what is called weapon of mass distraction rather than destruction is democracy that is used by the U.S. in every single country that is refusing to submit to the U.S. hegemony. If you look throughout the history, we know that Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, Indonesia 55, Brazil in the 60s, Chile 73, Nicaragua in the 80s, the examples are infinite where there were elected government and were toppled by the U.S. So therefore, the U.S. is not looking for the democracy per se, but is looking how to con people and then use very beautiful words and values to go and attack countries and the state that fear their competition or their presence on the world stage. And if we look at the U.S. best allies in the Middle East, for example, they all are non-democratic states who have never been elected by the population. If we look at the Gulf countries, we hear what the U.S. president is saying about how, for example, President Trump, how he loves dictators, presidents. We see how the attack on Iran that is commanded and directed by a population who elect their own parliament, unlike all the other states, most of the other states in the Middle East. And we see how the election, for example, of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We see what's happening in Yemen and the war that is lasting for 6 years by the Americans and the Saudis against a population that opted to put itself under the control of a leadership that represents a large part of the population. This is a real democracy that the Americans are fighting, and that is very clear that the Americans use this word and these summits to gather all its vessels, like the Europeans, who just follow the U.S. policy without any argument, and to attack China.
Elijah, let me get Fabrizio in on this discussion. Well, Fabrizio, you heard what Elijah said, basically using the word democracy, but being anything but a democracy. And it just seems that the U.S. Is trying to divide the world even more. I mean, that's what Beijing has accused Washington of, inciting division the world over. Your take on this?
Yeah, it seems that this kind of arrangement for the summit on democracy is basically trying to divide in the world. In my opinion, the United States, they want to show to the world that they have the monopoly of the term of the democracy. That is ridiculous, okay? Because if we see the violation of the principle of the democracy and the human rights in particular in the territory of the United States and outside, we see an incredible violation. We have in the United States the highest incarceration rate of the world. We have they have allowed a system like Guantanamo prison to exist, and we have these infinite wars that are lasting for, let's say, many years from 9/11 and even before. But, if I can say something why, in my opinion, we had this meeting, that we have this summit of democracy, is an agenda of Biden that is at two levels. One is for internal reason and one for external one. Internal reason, we don't have to forget that soon, next year, we will be the midterm election, and Biden wanted to reassure the global elites of the existence of this policy that is in opposition to the Trump one. The second point is a clear message, super clear message to China and especially to Russia. Not inviting them, but also what they have, what they have said during this during summit, and also which people they have invited. Okay, because they didn't invite only the prime minister, but they invite also people that doesn't represent at all, doesn't represent nobody actually.
Okay, all right. Well, let me cross back over to Elijah. Those that are saying, I mean, China is one that talks about basically the U.S. It's as if they want another Cold War. It's that they have put up the Berlin Wall again, and it's those countries who are so-called democratic and those who are autocratic, according to Washington. I mean, what is the overall goal here? What really are they trying to do? Is it that they want to increased tensions, or your evaluation of it, Elijah?
I think what the U.S. is afraid of is the growing influence of China that is offering a completely different model than the U.S. The U.S. is offering a model where it is imposing itself on government and population, while China is approaching the population in a different way, where it believed that the construction project, rebuilding of the infrastructure, is very useful for the countries of different countries in Africa and in the Middle East to rebuild the society and push away the state of war where everybody can benefit from business. Now, that is extremely damaging to the U.S. hegemony, where the U.S. adopt a completely different model of control and dominance. And the control of dominance, it's offering destruction, tens of thousands of people killed in Afghanistan, hundreds of thousands in Iraq. This is the model that the Americans are offering. And the model that the Chinese are offering is extremely threatening to the U.S. concept and to the image in the Middle East. That is all what is about.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point that you've just made, Elijah. Let me pick up on that, Fabrizio, with Elijah basically saying it's more of a fear of competition, basically, from the United States because of China. If what Elijah said is true, basically talking about the model that the Chinese use, I mean, wouldn't it be beneficial for the United States to reevaluate and sort of tweak its, if you want to say, business model and change it? I mean, when it sees that it is deteriorating rapidly and the Chinese are continuing to expand across the world, why wouldn't they change the way that they do what they do?
Because I think that, you know, what our guest said, that I definitely agree, but there is a mechanism that is already existing for decades that is linked to the weapon manufacturing that is, we have seen the data just 2 weeks ago that the United States has the largest manufactured weapon and selling around the world. For them, this is a business, you know, and you know, they create money and they destroy the money over the other people through a different kind of war, okay, through conventional war, hybrid war, and other things. I think that the China for them is a double challenge, is a mental challenge because it challenges the system. And it challenges also the economy because China is growing very, very fast with the new technology, and now with in the last few years with this infrastructural project, the Belt and Road Initiative, that is already existing in Central Asia and in other parts of the world. So it's a challenge that they have to contain. They use this word contain. In my opinion, they don't have the mind to change their mentality because there are too many interests. There are too many interests in this geopolitics activity.
What about that, Elijah? Too many interests in this the way that it's set up right now. Would you say then that the United States basically has sacrificed itself for a few, for the military-industrial complex, that it is not looking at the interests of Americans or overall for the country, but of that elite few, and that's why we see the situation that we're witnessing, or your evaluation?
The problem is the majority of the Americans don't know what's happening in the rest of the world. Therefore, it is really an American administration that is taking up the policy of remaining on top of the world. Well, that's gone because the era of hegemony and unilateral hegemony of the world is over. When Russia has woken up in 2015 and engaged in the war in Syria to stop the jihadists from overthrowing the Syrian government, and the role of China that is supporting Russia with at the United Nations to stop any act of war against Iran and other countries, this is representing a serious challenge to the U.S. The U.S. behavior, from their point of view, is sending soldiers overseas to fight wars and die only for the control of the U.S., but there are no interest for the U.S. to remain, for example, in northeast Syria just to take the oil. In Texas, there is more oil than in the North Australia. So it's only a question of disturbing and destruction and not the construction
of the countries in need. This is the model that the Americans are offering, and the American population is not aware of it. This is why the American administration can get away with it, because they don't have to explain anything to their population, and there is no accountability for whatever the U.S. is doing, and there is a clear violation of the international law when there is no other country, including the European, who are contesting the U.S. behavior anywhere in the world.
Well, Fabrizio, I mean, isn't it ironic when we look at this whole situation that Washington hosted this summit on International Human Rights Day, and the day that journalist Julian Assange's court ordered him to be extradited to the United States for doing nothing more than exposing the abuses of the U.S. military. I mean, where does this democracy, or even the word democracy, fit into this scenario? It takes a lot of arrogance, one could say, for the United States to even hold such a summit and call itself the leader of the democratic world. Your take?
Yeah, it's absolutely it's like a joke, as you said. I mean, about the moment when Assange has basically is prosecuted and has the chance to be extradited in the United States, this one it represents one of the most important human rights that we have: the right of a democracy to the free press, to the information, to the journalists. This one is quite an amazing point, you know. But I would like to say this one, that because I believe that this summit is just a propaganda tool. It's just a propaganda tool. Okay, propaganda works on emotion. It doesn't work on rational. And they have used another day that also has a lot of significance for the American people, the 7th of December, that was the 80th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And you know what's happened the 7th of December? We have the video conference, Biden, Biden, Putin, one day of resting, because of course they have to rest one day. And then we have this 2 days meeting that is nonsense meeting 9 and 10. So has been created this propaganda tool on the emotion. You know, it's just a propaganda things. We don't have to think other than that.
Mm-hmm. You say propaganda, that it's just propaganda. But well, let me turn to Elijah. Fabrizio says it's propaganda, but with this type of propaganda, I want to look at the type of division that it can cause and actually escalate the situation, whether we're talking about relations between Washington and Beijing or Washington and Russia. We saw that they invited Taiwan, but of course not China. At the end of the day, this type of conference and dividing between basically drawing that line in the sand between those who are with us and those who are against us, I mean, what does it do? It does not exactly set the stage easy to deal with things in a way that states can actually talk and try to end or lessen hostilities. How do you see it?
Well, I see the propaganda is a very powerful tool to manipulate the popular opinion and blur the truth about the real objective behind it. And the propaganda used by the U.S., which is very powerful, and the U.S. is very good at it, has been used throughout the years by several countries. And we know that this club that was invited to the summit doesn't include countries who have freedom and democracy of their ruling. So basically, who is with us is not, who is not with us is against us. That is a theory introduced also by George Bush when he went to war and invaded Iraq without the permission of the United Nations, but only creating fear and anger. And that is exactly what propaganda uses, and disinformation and misinformation. All these are part of the tools that are essential to the U.S. to try and spread its message across the world with a very beautiful titles like democracy and human rights, but if we dig a little bit of what the U.S. is doing throughout the world, it's completely far away from respect of human rights, respect of freedom of press, as you rightly mentioned, Julian Assange, and every single law is violated by the U.S., and that is in the name of democracy and in the name of human rights.
Well, Fabrizio, China has talked about with the United States as far as the human rights are, the lack thereof, even inside of the United States itself. It talked about the minority community and what it goes through in the United States, and also talked about color revolutions around the world. So when we talk about propaganda, on the one hand, we have Americans who have probably witnessed a lot of this oppression. And on the other side, we have people throughout the world who've heard about or witnessed, of course, the United States interference in their country. With that being said, and you also said about propaganda being so effective, so then what needs to be done to counter this? If people are witnessing these abuses by the U.S., but then their propaganda can convince them otherwise, I mean, what needs to be done that people understand the reality of the regime in Washington?
We should talk more about this kind of tool that they use, because the propaganda is used for color revolution that actually the color revolution that we have experienced, for example, in China, in Hong Kong, basically it was invented by an American guy that the name is Gene Sharp, that he started to distribute manual and videos and these kind of things. So first of all, the people, they need to have the knowledge. They need to have the knowledge of what the dangers that color revolution propaganda can bring. But the problem that I can see, that all the mainstream media in the Western countries, basically they don't pass this narrative. So it's extremely difficult, I tell you, it's extremely difficult. And the only possibility to bring knowledge to the people is the alternative media.
Okay.
I can tell you, there are many people that now they start.
And social media too. And I'm so sorry, I have to interrupt you.
We're
out of time. I appreciate both of you, though, being with me. Veteran journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, and writer and political commentator Fabrizio Goduni out of Como, Italy. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The Senate voted against a bipartisan resolution to block a $650 million weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Sharon Zhang and Mike Ludwig, journalists. This article is published under the heading Senate Rejects Sanders' Resolution to Block $650 Million Weapon Sales to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned for more. The Senate voted against a bipartisan resolution to block a $650 million weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, rejecting a bid by Senator Bernie Sanders and progressive and Republican lawmakers to stop the sale. The resolution was voted down 67-30. Most Republicans voted against the resolution except for Senators Ron Paul and Mike Lee, who had teamed up with Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and others in the Democratic caucus to introduce the measure. 21 Democrats joined the Republicans in voting no. Advocates of the resolution say the weapon sales will help Saudi Arabia advance its brutal blockade of Yemen, which is at the center of one of the world's worst ongoing humanitarian crises as a result of the war by U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Although aid groups are attempting to assist the roughly 20.7 million Yemenis, nearly 80% of the country's population who urgently need humanitarian assistance, the Saudi aerial blockade of the Sana'a airport has been preventing aid from reaching citizens. Meanwhile, Yemen's economy is on the verge of collapse. Human rights groups and Yemeni-led advocacy organizations have condemned the weapon sale and recently sent a letter to Congress urging lawmakers to pass the resolution. Hassan Tayeb, the director of Middle East Policy for Friends Committee on National Legislation, told Truthout that approving the arms sales sends a message of impunity to Saudi Arabia and removes key leverage that the U.S. could use to end the war. In a joint statement released by the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Representative Ilhan Omar and Caucus Chair Representative Pramila Jayapal said the blockade has almost completely blocked medical supplies from entering the war-torn Yemen. The blockade has also amounted to a death sentence for Yemenis seeking care abroad, they said. The world's largest humanitarian crisis is escalating. Last month, Saudi Arabia tightened its blockade on Yemen, permitting just 3% of the fuel the country needs into Yemen's major port, the lawmakers wrote. Saudi warplanes enforce a blockade on Yemen's airspace, threatening to shoot down commercial and humanitarian flights. Ahead of the vote, the White House released a statement of administration policy, a more forceful version of a regular statement, saying the administration strongly opposes the resolution. This goes against promises Biden made during his presidential campaign when he vowed to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. In response to the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the dissident killed by a team of Saudi agents in 2018. Biden said, "I would end the subsidies that we have and the sale of material to the Saudis who are going in and They are murdering children and they are murdering innocent people, and so they have to be held accountable. In this statement, the White House claimed that the arms sales will only go toward defensive actions for Saudi Arabia. Therefore, it won't contradict Biden's previous pledge to help the war. Senator Chris Murphy, a longtime critic of Saudi Arabia's role in the war, also voted against blocking the sale, citing the same reasons as the White House. The arms sales divided the Democratic caucus, with a majority of Democrats lining up against Biden and voting for the resolution. Sanders said on the Senate floor before the vote, "The United States must do everything in our power to bring this brutal and horrific war to an end. Exporting more missiles to Saudi Arabia does nothing but further this conflict and pour more gasoline on an already raging fire." Why in the world would the United States of America reward such a regime which has caused such pain in Yemen with more weapons? Sanders asked. "My friends, the answer is we should not," he added. Paul also condemned the sale before the vote, saying, "We could stop this war if we really had the will to do it. All of America should be appalled at the humanitarian disaster caused by the Saudi blockade of Yemen." When the resolution was introduced, Paul said the sale, if allowed to advance, would send a message to Saudi Arabia that their reprehensible behavior should be rewarded. The United States of America has provided the Saudi-led coalition with billions of dollars in weapons, training, and military support, playing an instrumental role in the destruction of Yemen for nearly 7 years. Donald Trump, in particular, was determined to support Saudi Arabia, going so far to veto several bipartisan measures to stop weapon sales to the country during his tenure. In 2018, Sanders and allied Republicans led the Senate in passing a historic war powers resolution to end the U.S. role in the war, which was not authorized by Congress. The resolution died in the GOP-controlled House. The $650 million sales will go on despite the wishes of the American public, which largely disapproves of the sale. A Data for Progress poll found that 64% of likely voters oppose the sale, with opposition nearly even across political affiliations.